Welcome to Strategy Talk, where the editors and writers at strategypage.com discuss news as history and give you a unique view of events around the world. I'm Dan Masterson, publisher of strategypage.com, your host. We'll be talking to Jim Dennigan, well-known military analyst, author, and editor of strategypage.com, and Al Nofi, military historian and author. Al compiles and writes our popular CIC section on the site. Today, we're going to talk about paramilitary units, past, present, and future. Jim, we cover a topic on the site called paramilitary. Now, a lot of people don't really know what paramilitary means.
Okay, good.
I mean, what does that term actually mean? What does it cover?
Well, paramilitary are forces that are somewhat of a cross between regular military and police. We don't have too many in the United States. The National Guard, which is each state's, you know, private army, so to speak, they often act in a paramilitary fashion when they are mobilized by the state governor who commands them when the, you know, the federal government doesn't grab them, and uses them for the disaster relief. For example, down in the North Texas where they had the recent hurricane, you still got half a million people without light. There's many other utilities that are not functioning, and they bring in the National Guard to provide security, to provide services. The National Guard contains engineer units, signal units, and what have you, and that's paramilitary. In Europe, though, they have, you know, classic paramilitary units, and those are basically what we call in the English world gendarmerie. These are units that are organized militarily. They often live in barracks, at least the unmarried guys. But they mainly perform police work. Some of them are riot police, where you literally have platoons and companies of guys who train regularly to deal with riots. These are the guys you see with the plastic shields and the head and the face masks and what have you in the clubs. But mostly they are simply used as a national level police force that could be sent anywhere where there's, you know, disorder. Europe has a long history of civil disorder, and you still have it in Europe. For example, last year you had the riots of the young Muslim youths outside of Paris burning cars. It really got out of hand. Now you rarely see that in the United States, but you know, the widespread violence like that still happens in Europe, and they still have the paramilitary forces. In the Middle East, they have paramilitary forces, which are fairly standard procedure, because most of those countries are either monarchies or dictatorships, and you need that strategic reserve. In Iraq, when Saddam was in charge, the Republican Guard was not strictly speaking paramilitary, that was part of its function. In other words, it was the Imperial Guard, as it were, literally the Presidential Guard, that would take care of any uprising if the police, or the army failed to, take care of it. Actually, most of these communist countries and your apolitical dictatorships like in the Middle East, they tend to have 3, 4 or more security forces, each with a paramilitary component, just so they can keep an eye on each other. So basically, your paramilitary are, police with heavy weapons.
Now, Al, you have a historical perspective on this. Where did the paramilitary groups come from historically? Is it an outgrowth of the garrisons or that used to be in cities, or where did this concept develop?
Well, in some countries, like Italy, for example, the Carabinieri, they're actually the military police. They're the regular army military police.
Okay.
And since you used to have, in all countries, widespread banditry, you needed a force to go out and chase the bandits. So you could use the regular army to do that, which is about the only armed force you had in most countries. But that eventually got, questions of civil liberties, and besides, the army doesn't necessarily want to do that. They want to go and train for the real, real wars. So you develop like in France, the was it the Guard Republican, and in Italy the Carabinieri, who go out there and, you know, they're armed like military, and they often are quite good troops, but their primary mission was to chase the bandits.
Yeah, we have to remember that modern police forces, what we consider police forces, didn't exist 200 years ago.
Yeah.
I mean, there was no police. It was either paramilitary or nothing.
Yeah. The bandits could be unbelievably numerous. I mean,
look at Iraq today.
Yeah. In studying southern Italy, I came across bandit gangs of 600, 800 guys that you know, you required... basically, you commission somebody, a brigadier general, and he could raise 5,000-6,000 troops to go chasing them, you know. That kind of activity in many parts of the world didn't end in Europe, and certainly in Italy or Spain, for example, that didn't end until the mid-19th century. In England, anyone who's read a romance novel set in the 18th century encounters highwaymen, you know. That was still common. In fact, there was, you know, troops going after these guys.
Yeah, what really killed the large-scale banditry was the telegraph and the railroad. It then became possible for the government to quickly send people to any area where a local warlord, and that's what you call these bandit kings, because they literally take over an area. And they could move faster than an army could because they were basically lightly armed and they knew the territory. But once you had the telegraph and the railroad, these guys were just one by one, you know, wiped out. And these are the campaigns Al's talking about, you know, when they finally got the resources to systematically destroy them. They, you know, as Al pointed out, they disappeared by the 19th century. Done in by technology.
Yeah. Now,
yeah, done in by technology, yeah. And economics, I think.
Yeah.
As conditions improved somewhat through democratization, but more through introduction of liberal economic policies and whatnot, you know, the peasants didn't have as much incentive to support, you know, Cousin Giuseppe who's up in the mountains there or, you know, whoever it was.
Now,
although in Italy they insist, in some parts of southern Italy, the old ways, the old traditions still exist. But even then, they're under heavy attack these days, you know, by the anti-mafia, you know, task forces.
Well, now, the gangbang stuff is out, you know.
Right.
In the criminal activity, it's more like, you know, let's try to rob them with
a fountain pen.
Fountain pens, yes.
Yeah. Now in Iraq, we have, like, the Mahdi army and like that. Now, is that a paramilitary group or, you know, Hamas or some of these others that we see?
Well, the Mahdi army is your classic bandit gang, except they're using a religious justification. And they were trying to turn themselves into a paramilitary and ultimately military organization. But earlier this year, the Iraqi government decided, you know, before they got too powerful, to cut them down. And there was a classic, you know, paramilitary operation. They sent in police and army troops, and the Mahdi army fell apart. I mean, they basically looked around and said, we're snookered, and that's the end of that.
Now,
that's the other thing. When you're relying on a tribal basis, you know, you're likely to get outgunned. And you might not want to continue that.
Now, during various conflicts that countries get into, do they use their paramilitary forces as regular military, like in World War II or other conflicts of recent history? Do they mobilize them?
Yeah, in the case of European countries, the border guards, for example, you know, our border patrols are sort of like rent-a-cops. They sort of look, you know.
I'm sure some of your friends down there in Texas will appreciate that,
we'll certainly object. But right. But in Europe, border patrol are troops. They're paramilitary. They're often heavily armed. And in the World Wars, for example, the first casualties were among the border patrol people, who were out there with their standard rifle, just like the infantry would have, skirmishing with the cavalry patrols that are starting to advance across the border.
Most countries take their borders a lot more seriously than we do. The people in the United States are a little spoiled. Until recently, there still is not a lot of patrolling along the Mexican border, and there's never been much at all up in the Canadian border. But in Europe and even most of the rest of the world, not necessarily Africa, but you know parts of Asia and what have you, they take border security very seriously, and they have fairly large forces. As Al points out, you know, they're military or paramilitary, because they don't always have tanks and what have you. They often have armored cars and whatnot. But they are basically there to fight smugglers. Smuggling is a big business. It's big money. And the state is basically trying to hang on to that revenue. And, for example, Iran has been fighting a low-level war with Afghan heroin smugglers, heroin and opium, on their Afghan border for the last 5 years. And they're losing. I mean, there were several hundred. I used to report it regularly in Strategy Page, but then I realized this just happens all the time. I mean, so now I do an update every couple of months. I'll say, well, yeah, it's still going on out there. I'll give a recap on how many hundred people have been killed and wounded, and even more have been arrested. But there's too much money involved, and even though they've deployed, I think they have something like 20,000 or 30,000 soldiers. Various types of regular army, police, border patrol, and the guard, they are unable to defeat the guys they are up against because the smugglers, have an incentive, money, and they're well armed. And that same thing happened on the Tajik border before the Russians sent down two infantry divisions to help them close the border. And at that point, the Afghans decided, well, let's go through Iran. And the Iranian, and the Iranians blame us for all that.
Right. Yeah. Now, most of the militaries down in South America would be considered paramilitary because they don't have the heavy equipment and like that, right?
Well, not necessarily. Most countries in Latin America still have a regular military force. Now, they may not be well equipped or well trained or anything in several cases, but the assumption is that force is the one that's going to fight the outsiders. And then they will also often have a paramilitary internal security force. Partly that's because in coup prone countries, it's a good idea to have another armed force just in case,
Republican Guard.
Republican Guard, yeah. Now, in some countries, there's some difficulty with that. In Mexico, for example, there had been a national police until the revolution, but these guys, the primary function of these guys was to keep the peasants down. So come the revolution, that was kind of, having a national police was just not a good idea. Which has created problems now as the drug war has heated up, creating that national police force
all over again
in a very slow process.
Yeah, the federales are coming back.
In
South America, they do have heavy weapons, but they simply don't have as many as, say, in the United States or in Europe. And most of their troops are, indeed, just infantry. Most of those countries, they're reluctant to use the troops politically because you never know which way they're going to go. I mean, often it's a case of, the government wanting to put down a popular uprising. Well, if your troops are conscripts, which they still are in a lot of those countries, you're asking these guys to shoot their own people, as it were. And that often doesn't work. One of the big inventions of the 20th century was the modern police state. And what that does, although some of the techniques this modern police state uses are ancient, but one of them is, of course, to make sure you have a small but very loyal and highly trained and effective force of enforcers. And that's where these are the dreaded secret police. And this is what they tend to use. So your troops may be technically paramilitary in the way they're armed and equipped, but they're rarely used that way, except for, say something like, chasing if you have a bandit problem or something like that. But as Al points out, soldiers are not the best people to use. In Thailand, for example, they have a problem in the southern part of the country, which is Muslim. it's only about 5% of the population, but they have Islamic terrorists. Now, it turns out these Islamic terrorists are basically, you know, auxiliaries of the smuggling gang. Again, smuggling, it's a constant, you know, throughout most of the world. But, you know, there's been several thousand deaths in the last few years, you know, among a population of 2 million, to put it into proportion. And when the Thai sent down army troops to reinforce the police, the army troops basically caused more trouble because they were a little trigger happy. They didn't know how to deal with, you know, just arresting people or picking out who were the bad guys and who were not. And that basically inflamed the violence. So they've been a few years, you know, repairing the damage done by sending troops, regular troops, and the Thais have a good army. They're professional troops, but they're not cops. And that was the same problem we encountered over in Afghanistan and Iraq, where we basically had to retrain our soldiers, and we did it fairly quickly, to be basically paramilitary.
Right.
And that's why you have complaints in the Pentagon now. He says, well, we got a splendid paramilitary force, but what happens if we have to fight, you know, against a regular army? And, of course, we point out in Strategy Page that it's not as big a problem as it seems because the American troops have been getting an awful lot of combat experience. And for an infantryman, it doesn't make any difference if you're on a battlefield being shot at by regulars or, you know, irregulars. You're learning how to operate in a combat environment. And it doesn't take them long to regain their, you know, reacquire their skills for operating, you know, against a regular army. But the two types of warfare do have some fundamental differences.
Right. Now, a lot of people don't realize that in Iraq that we were even taking our normally mounted troops and sending them on foot patrols and like that.
Oh, everybody was on foot patrols. Basically, the artillery and the armor troops, because they had more combat training than combat support troops, you know, like, you know, supply or logistics or anything like that. Yeah, they were dismounted and they ran them through a week or two of refreshing on patrolling and what have you. Although they tended to not do that as much as they could because they found that the regular infantry were much more effective if they got into trouble. So the artillery and armor units, when they were deployed as infantry, if they had to send them outside the wire, they would send them to areas where they weren't expecting trouble, because they knew they would get more they would suffer more casualties if these artillery guys or tank crews, you know, got into a heavy duty, you know, mix up with irregular troops and what have you. But yeah, that was very unpopular among the tankers and the artillery crews. But you know, it was a wise use of resources because you simply weren't using most of those tanks and artillery, and the guys otherwise would just be sitting there getting into other trouble.
Right.
And we've done this before. I mean, in the Indian Wars and the Philippine Insurrection, artillerymen frequently served as infantry because at most you might need one gun. You know, when you're chasing folks, so it's not that revolutionary an idea.
Yeah, and they got to use those neat swords they had.
Yeah, those neat short swords were really good.
Yeah.
Probably more useful skirmishing with Indians than sabers. There's an interesting issue you remember when there's this so-called debate. You know, that leftists in America claim that we should be treating terrorism as a police problem, and rightists think we should be treating terrorism as a military problem. Well, the answer is, it's both. And someone coined a phrase, paramilitary war. And if you think about what our guys are doing in Iraq, they're doing an incredible amount of police work. They're using a lot of the techniques that were introduced in the late 80s, early 90s, that have drastically reduced crime in places like New York, you know, where it's identifying people and who they're connected to and getting out there in the street and putting more presence on the street rather than, you know, riding around and smashing concentrations of the enemy, because there aren't any concentrations of the enemy.
Yeah, one thing we pointed out in Strategy Page again and again were the unsung heroes of all that. It was the reservists who were police, and there are a lot of reservists who are police. I don't know I used to think it was just New York, but apparently it's nationwide. The police people in police forces are much more likely to join the reserves than, you know, non-police. Well, you had thousands of those guys over there, and they just couldn't help but say, hey, this looks familiar. Why don't you try this? And they literally, you know, brought on board, the same tools, the software, you know, the CompStat that was invented in New York City and rapidly spread across the country, and just plain old policing techniques. You know, you get information, where's the map, you know, where are the incidents, who are the people, you know, there's obviously an organization involved there, who's the gang leader, and it was Crime Busters all over again, and it was tremendously successful.
Now, one of the things, just to finish out this conversation, is that how do mercenaries fit into the whole paramilitary scheme?
The mercenaries have been around for a long time. I think, Al, you were the one who dug up the fact that the Marines hired several thousand Mongolian cavalrymen during World War II to guard weather sites or something.
The Navy weather mission in Mongolia there. They had thousands of cavalrymen on the U.S. payroll to protect the weather stations.
And that it goes back even farther than that. You know, the idea of hiring, civilian contractors, as it were, is ancient. I mean, basically, it's the old mercenary thing. The Romans did it. You'd always have a situation where you had more money than troops. Yet there were organized groups of guys, armed men, you know, in the area that were willing to and were reliable and willing to, you know, hire on. And you just took that, you know, money and you hired them. It went out of, where most journalists get lost in this particular issue is that they don't have a historical view. For the last 100 years, in the 19th century, when conscription and a lot of money came along at the same time, the military decided, instead of hiring a lot of these independent contractors, you know, for support and for additional muscle, you can just conscript them. In other words, it was cheaper because conscripts were paid practically nothing. You know, mercenaries, you know, usually got paid, you know, twice what the average working man got, you know, danger pay, as it were.
Mm-hmm.
But when you had conscription, you could just hire, you know, just conscript these guys. And have them do the support jobs. He had all the riflemen, all the combat troops that needed, and the contractors, by and large, went away, and they went out of the public consciousness. And so now people look at all these contractors coming out of the walls. Why? Because we've gotten rid of conscription. We have plenty of money, but we can't afford to hire. We can't afford to have as many of these volunteer, you know, professional troops as we've got now. But they're getting paid, you know, 3, 4, 5. Depending on the country, 10 times as much as the conscript is.
Right. Yeah. You've got Blackwater in Iraq, and a lot of people don't realize what they're doing is guarding other government agencies that are over there in Iraq, too.
Most of 80, 90% of Blackwater's work is guarding VIPs. The people who are the lower level, you know, armed contractors, the guys from South America, you know, Africa, Uganda, you know, is apparently a popular place, Gurkhas from Nepal, they are basically just guarding bases. So the myth that you have these high-tech mercenary commandos running around is a myth.
Right. And basically they're doing...
They're security guards. They're building security.
Right, and doing the typical paramilitary type of thing, which is guarding the base.
Exactly. And they've done a very good job of it.
Right.
They're getting paid 4 or 5 times what they get paid at home, and they have about one-third the casualty rate of the combat troops. You know, the guys in regular military, you know, units are suffering. So the danger isn't as great. And indeed, we did a piece on the strategy page on this recently. With the 80% decline in violence in Iraq, there's been a huge increase in the number of people trying to get these jobs, so they've cut the pay in half, supply and demand.
Right.
But they're still making, you know, much more than they'd make, you know, in any other job back home. But, you know, the word got around that, hey, you don't even get shot at much anymore. And the word got around in general that this is a pretty good deal. You had guys going back 2 or 3 times. You know, they work on 1 year, you know, contracts, and a lot of them roll over, sign up, you know, before they even leave, or just go home for, you know, a few weeks of vacation and come right back for another, you know, year of it. But they're basically the same kind of, you know, military contractors you have, you know, guarding your office building.
Well, I think that pretty much wraps it up for us for today. I think hopefully the people that listen to this will have a better understanding of what paramilitary groups are and what they do. Thank you, Alan, Jim. We'll talk to you next week.
Goodbye.
Have a good day.
Bye.